welcome back to yet another episode of the Silmarillion Film Project. I'm your co-host, Dave Kale, and we're back again in our 12-episode sprint through the script outlines that have planned for Season 2 of the Silmarillion Film Project. Of course, originally the plan was to go through all of these in, I think, one episode. No, then we revised and said two. And then I think we got about halfway through the ones we planned to do last time. So I think we're ultimately going to end up having an entire separate season of the podcast to go through the script outlines for the that we generated as a result of the previous podcast season. But, you know, it's just more content for you, the listener. So really,
it
we're thinking
funny
of you
I
guys.
Was thinking about, oh, my God, season three is going to be what, like, we're going to start it in, like, June.
It's true. If we start averaging a year and a half of real time per season of the Silmarillion Film Project, then we're definitely going to have to be leaving this show to our grandchildren.
Yes.
But the good news is I pretty much never have to come up with a new podcast idea again, because here we are and here we shall remain. That's great. Yeah. Everybody. And, this is cool. I do think the over under for number of episodes number of sessions we will take to do the episode outlines is three. So I'm confident, super confident that we will make it in three. So before we start, quick two announcements, which are really cool. One, which is kind of urgent and sort of exciting, is I had mentioned that Vroen Flieger was doing her two-session seminar called Tolkien in the Dark. I mentioned this, I believe, last week. And the first one was meant to be last Monday. So she's doing two sessions. She's doing it's called Tolkien in the Dark, because she's looking at some of the really quite strikingly dark and different, very different from the feel of pretty much anything else Tolkien wrote that he did in his early days, namely the story of Kullervo and the Lay of Eotru and Itrun, the Breton lay that he wrote, which almost nobody's read. So, these are things that are going to be like sort of help you to see Tolkien in a new light, see him working through and struggling with, different things that we, and especially early. The story of Kullervo is the first thing Tolkien ever wrote that we have. I mean, it is before the Book of Lost Tales. This is like Tolkien being like, hey, I think I'll write stories. I mean, it's that early in Tolkien's career. So, you're looking at like teenage Tolkien, essentially, when you're reading Kullervo. So it's pretty amazing. Anyway, the session on Kullervo was meant to be this past Monday, the 6th, but we had a catastrophic technical failure on Monday, our Netmoot program just would not cooperate at all, and we ended up having to postpone it. So it's been postponed to Monday. So this coming Monday, February 13th, at 5:30, Dr. Flieger is going to be doing her Kullervo seminar, and then on Thursday, the 16th, at 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time, she's going to do the Lay of Eotru and Itrun. So you're going to get a chance to be with Dr. Flieger twice this coming week and hear both of those. So if you missed it last week, you didn't miss it, turns out. So that's cool. Anyway, good. So that's going to be awesome. The other thing I wanted to draw your attention to is Mythmoot. So the Mythmoot preliminary program has been released. If you would like to get a glimpse of some of the awesome things that we have planned for Mythmoot, you can check that out. So if you go to the Mythmoot page on mythgard.org, or if you go to signumuniversity.org and scroll down just a tiny bit to the events area, you can see a link to the Mythmoot page there also, and you can download our preliminary program, which is awesome. I am so excited about Mythmoot. I hope you guys will, hope that many of you will get a chance to come and join us there. All right, but let's jump back into the...
May I add a film announcement?
I wanted
to let everybody know that the voting for casting will be open later today. The 10th of... is today the 10th? No, is it the 10th?
Yes.
I guess it is. And it's going to be open for 3 weeks, so... because we're having that extra script session, that's good news, because that allows the folks that are listening asynchronously. So you go to the board, same forum, casting forum, you'll see specifically season two casting poll or something to that effect when you go in, when it's opened up, and there are some great nominations. So go in, do your research, cast your vote, and we will close voting in 3 weeks' time, and then the week after that will be our casting show.
So great. That's that. Great. Yeah, so you go to somfilm.mythgard.org, right? And then you go to is the casting I'm forgetting the architecture. Is the casting a top
casting
forum?
Is a separate forum.
Okay.
So you click on casting, and then under season two, there will be a specific. It's not there yet, but it will be when you'll know it's open when you see the thread called season two casting vote casting or something like that. Something about voting.
Right.
And then just click in there, and what it'll be in there actually is the link to the survey. So it's a SurveyMonkey survey. So you just click in and then click through to the survey, and it's just multiple choice, you know, click, 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 click. And then, of course, all of the nominations and the reasonings behind and the photos and information about all the nominations are on the discussion board. So you can always refer back to that.
Yeah. Awesome. That'll be good. I can't wait. I usually wait to look until, like, because we get to make the final vote. So I wait until the final vote comes in, and then I go through and look, and it's always fun.
There's some great, great nominations. Oh my gosh, you guys have done just an awesome job, and I'm feeling really old because there are quite a few that I don't recognize.
oh, wonderful.
I know.
There are quite a few that I do not recognize also. So
I thought we were...
Oh, good. I don't feel so bad.
I thought we were just going to resurrect old actors with CGI.
Well, yeah. I mean, now that we, you know, now that we have the Admiral Tarkin option, I think, you know, we can stop leaning on the younger generation. You know,
such a bummer. We could have had Humphrey Bogart as Manway.
Dang. No.
Yeah, I see. We're getting lots of emphatic no's from our. But you know, it's funny. The execs are all like, you know, cutting edge, and the project team are all like conservative and stuffy. You know, what's up with that?
Boy, not only that, but it's like no.
I know we're getting yelled at here in text form.
Boy.
Oh well.
This is how it works.
Though. I can abide by that.
You're just going to get
it. Interestingly enough, I think it was Hakon. There's somebody, I think it was Hakon that was the one that did this, but a lot of, and I think appropriately, Norwegian actors, which I just love.
Ah, cool.
So anyway.
Cool.
So go to, not us, not the execs, but everybody else, go check it out. Because
that's right.
There's a lot of really good nominations, and it'll take a while to kind of go through and plow through, and people have included their IMDb pages and all that stuff. Very, very interesting stuff. Anyway, so
yeah, cool.
That's that.
Okay, all right. So I wanted to start. We have a bunch of really interesting things. There are a bunch of really interesting issues that the outlines raise, at least raised in my mind this week. But first, I wanted to share something, kind of picking up on. And I know, like, probably you're going to be thinking that we already talked about this too much last week, but I don't care, because I want to go back to Sauron for a minute. Because see, here's the story. I am this year, as I explained on my social media accounts a while back, I've decided to do it. Normally, I do it my Tolkien reread. Like, I've been rereading The Silmarillion, Hobbit, and The Lord of the Rings every year starting in January for decades now. But this year, I decided I wanted to do something a little more fun and ambitious. So I've decided to try to do a rough, not a really, really thorough yet, because I don't have time to compile the spreadsheet, but to do a rough whole chronological reread of the entire Tolkien corpus. So I started with the story of Kuurvo, and now I'm in the Book of Lost Tales, and I'm going to go forward that way. So I'm going to do the whole Middle-earth history of Middle-earth thing and all the ancillary texts and everything in chronological order. It's going to be really fun. Anyway,
that won't be confusing.
No, it won't be confusing at all. Well, see, Nick, I've given up on the confusion thing, because I'm teaching a class on the Fellowship of the Ring at the same time as I'm teaching a class on the Return of the Shadow and talking about the Silmarillion and the Silmarillion Film Project. So I'm just, And, you know, and but it's, of course, it's no different from in previous months, you know, when I've been teaching The Lost Road and like teaching the 1937 Quintus Silmarillion at the same time that I'm trying to work through the published Silmarillion here. So I'm just so confused all the time that I've just embraced it and decided to, you know, to sort of accept it as a way of life. So anyway, so I'm reading the Book of Lost Tales, and I just finished volume one of the Book of Lost Tales the other day. And in the last chapter of the Book of Lost Tales, part one, is Gilfonan's tale, which is the travail of the Noldorli and the coming of men. But here's the paragraph that really kind of, I would say, jumped off the page, except of course I was listening to it. So here's the, I could say it jumped out of my iPhone, but of course it's meant to do that. That's how I read it. Anyhow, never mind. Here's the paragraph that really struck me. Now the tale tells of a certain fae, and names him too the wizard. This is, of course, the person from whom Sauron ultimately will be derived. And names him too the wizard, for he was more skilled in magics than any that have ever dwelt ever yet beyond the land of Valinor. And wandering about the world, he found the bit of unintelligible manuscript, elves, and he drew them to him, and taught them many deep things, and he became as a mighty king among them, and their tales name him the Lord of Gloaming, and all the fairies of his realm, Hisildi, or the Twilight People. So this is the guy, this is Tu the Sorcerer, who's going to become the Necromancer, eventually. You know, he's going to be cast as the Necromancer and Servant of Melkor. Now we have him in the Book of Lost Tales, and this is which is one of the sketchiest and most fragmentary tales of the Book of Lost Tales. But nevertheless, we have this idea of Tu the Wizard, who is clearly, he's obviously shadowy. He's called the Lord of Gloaming, but morally shadowy as well. I mean, he's not explicitly allied with Melkor, but he's also not clearly allied with the regular Valar either. So he's kind of his loyalties are in question. But what he does is he goes about making a kingdom, He drew the elves to him and taught them many deep things, and he became as a mighty king, and their tales name him the Lord of Gloaming. So, of course, one reaction I had is, oh, that's really cool. I like Lord of Gloaming, right? I mean, that's a good title. I couldn't help, of course, but, you know, I read this like a couple days after we had been having our Sauron discussion last time, and it just kind of cemented in my mind that we've been kind of moving in this direction anyway, right? I mean, we started off at the beginning of the season conceiving that, like, if a year ago we had to give a one sentence synopsis of what Sauron's activity in season two would be, we would have said, well, he's going to start firing up the super secret necromantic orc project, right? As that's kind of where we were with that before. But we've been kind of moving away from that, right? Slowly moving away from the idea of him actually creating orcs, like tormenting orcs, tormenting elves, and deliberately turning them into twisted orcs over the time. And so I'm wondering if we don't go an entire further step in that direction. There is, of course, a major challenge with this thing that I'm about to say, which I'm sure you'll see long before I get there. But anyway, wouldn't it make sense? So just thinking about Sauron in the abstract, especially Sauron as we have him here, remember Sauron the newly fallen, right? The newly allegiance changed but not yet entirely corrupted himself, Sauron, who still believes that he's doing the right thing, you know, that he's doing the best thing anyway. That he is, Melkor's gone, right? So he still adheres to Melkor's vision. I don't think he would see himself as keeping the seat warm for Melkor. He may believe that Melkor might return someday, but I don't think he's necessarily counting on it. I mean, Melkor got hauled off in chains, so he's kind of the boss now, and I don't think he would be, he would have any problem with being the boss now. So anyway, so here he is in Middle-earth, and they're the elves. Right? So what's he going to do? Is he going to capture them and torture them? I don't think he's going to capture them and torture them. I think he's going to try to make them into his servants. He's going to, I mean, to like draw them in and teach them many deep things and become as a mighty king among them. That kind of sounds like a good idea, right? As far as something that he might attempt to do, that he would see them as instruments that he could use, you know, as allies who would be valuable, as underlings, you know, as servants. So he would approach them not in love, obviously, but he would show them, he would I think rather awe them and get them to serve him as faithful servants. And of course we can see an obvious distinction. I love, it comes up, and see, this is me like gently segueing into an actual episode 5 thing. Episode 5 is the one wherein the Balrogs go elf hunting, which I love. So the fact that the Balrogs see it just like a sport to kill elves, because that's what they are, they're thugs. Whereas Sauron sees this as a shocking waste of resources, and he instead is trying to rule them. He wants to bring as many under his sway as possible. And this, by the way, is kind of more in line with what we see him wanting to do kind of for the rest of his career, right? Both with, you think about his MO with Numenor, you think about his MO with Celebrimbor and the Jewelsmiths, you think about the Ring of Power, right? I mean, he wants to dominate the wills of others. He wants them to serve him. Like he wants to be called Lord and for them to be his underlings. And so I would think that would be his goal. But again, he's not going to be doing it in Dominion necessarily. He's going to try to win them over to his side so that they can be his allies and his soldiers against the Balrogs, because they are clearly his rivals, and he disapproves of their tactics. Now, all this I think could work out real. Oh, and by the way, so then you see the stroke of tragedy that happens at the end when Melkor returns. Melkor then returns, and he takes Sauron's servants, right? The elves that he's taken and that he's been, like, convincing / brainwashing, and Melkor then takes his elf servants and transforms them into orcs, because he, Melkor, is so ticked off, right? And this we see as part of, like, an externalization of his own fall. Melkor's own fall. And so I would think that Sauron would actually be repulsed by orcs, and he would despise orcs ever afterwards, and it would be you know, he would not approve. So that I think would be kind of interesting, the way that Sauron gets kind of marginalized at the end, and his whole plan gets kind of shot when Morgoth returns, which I think could set up some really interesting stuff for season 3. So, as I was thinking through all that stuff, inspired by the Lord of Gloaming and this half paragraph in the Book of Lost Tales, I thought that was all awesome. But of course, Nick, I don't doubt you can see the obvious problem that it leaves us with, as far as adapting the published Silmarillion and the stuff we've already done in season 1, right? Namely, so why does he do the Dark Rider thing? Why is he abducting folks? Because that doesn't seem to fit with this at all.
Yeah, it would make it rather difficult for it, because that would give Melkor a very, very, very small amount of time in which to convert these even darkish elves into orcs.
Right.
Like, as it is, the project hasn't come into its full, you know, its full potential when he gets back, but at least there's something there, and there's kind of like the pipeline already exists.
right. Sauron has made the physical plant. He just hasn't done it. Yeah. Of course, one thing we could do is he could tinker with them, because that's who he is, right? You know, Sauron tinkers with things. We saw him doing with the werewolves before, right?
Right.
So he could be wanting to enhance them. Right, to believe he can make like Elf 2.0, right? Which would be better anti-Balrog soldiers, and he would, you know, he would have learned his lesson. Like, Drug Lewin is kind of useful, but like ultimately it was really kind of a failed experiment. It didn't work out at all like he had planned, but you know, he's learned from that experiment and he thinks he can do better the second time. So the idea of him doing stuff to the elves and trying to change them can already happen. But I'm not sure how much passage of time needs to happen. I mean, if Morgoth just comes back and exerts his... and I don't know what we want to do with the process, or if we want to depict the process. But I would think it's possible that the process could be relatively swift. We also do get a little bit of time. We're not going to want to do, and now here we're getting sucked into like details of season three. But there is some passage of time, like between Feanor giving his speech in Tirion and the crossing of the Hel Caraxa, say, even the crossing, and the burning of the ships. There's going to be some time. I mean, they have to travel up the coast and everything, and it's going to take a more, you know, this is not a journey of a few days. Even in the most conservative estimates, Tolkien has that taking a couple years, which I think is going to be hard to do on film. But anyway, it doesn't have to be instantaneous. Anyway, so like the pipeline, having him making some alterations, right? But again, with the difference in mind, right? He wants to turn them into like the ultimate servants, and you know his own like. Not.
It sounds almost like he's making drow.
It's something like that, you know, or at least doubtless it is from the servants of the dark elf servants of Sauron that the later legends of the drow grow. But anyway, it's the kind of thing that he's wanting to do. And then Melkor comes and takes it over, but he takes it over, well, not ham-fistedly in the sense that he's less competent than Sauron, but more malevolently. I mean, he is ticked off. He despises the elves, and so it's his despising of the elves that is chiefly reflected in the elves, the hideousness and savagery of the orcs. Sauron was already working to turn them into like the ultimate soldiers, but Sauron, or Morgoth rather, comes in and turns them into this like loathsome and self-loathing creatures that that they, you know, and like totally corrupted things that we all know and love. Anyway, I like that. I think it works. I think there will be time. It should be all right. But at the same time, what about the Dark Rider thing?
Right. Well, the Dark Rider thing would still be a problem. You could make the case that that's part of the orders from Melkor. Like, that's like a relic of the earlier situation. However, there's one thing that... because this entire time, the way that I had thought of it is... that Sauron doesn't really see the elves as people, in a sense. Like, he's aware of the fact that they're, that they're intelligent and whatnot. But if he sees them as almost like they're beasts, they're things, they're not Ionor, it wouldn't necessarily occur to him that torturing them is a wrong thing to do, you know, like that molding them in the way that the Snop project would be, would do. So there's a few things that you lose there. It makes the Dark Rider thing a little bit less impactful, but you can get around it. You kind of lose an opportunity to do anything with Tevildo if there's no torture going on.
He can torture them.
Yes, but that sets Sauron up against him rather than having them in relatively the same corner.
He can still be, he, Tevildo, can still be allied with Sauron. We were kind of already suggesting that Sauron is using Tevildo as, like, that he doesn't like him, you know, but that he's just, like,
he's using him as the bad cop.
Exactly. Well, yeah. No, I mean against the Balrogs. Like, you know, Tevildo has no truck with the Balrogs, and Sauron is like in a beggars can't be choosers situation when it comes to opposing the Balrogs. So, you know, he can side
allow Tivildo some toys.
Right. Well, he doesn't even have to know about it. Like, he could hate Tivildo. He could completely despise Tivildo privately. Who cares? But he's willing to make use of him because he's powerful and unscrupulous, and he can see uses for him. So he would consider him, let me not use pronouns, Sauron would consider Tivildo distasteful, annoying, but potentially useful in the larger struggle against the Balrogs. But he and Tivildo might be quite in opposition. Like, you know, because I would think, what does Sauron want, right? I mean, what Sauron wants is dominion.
Order.
And there is a trend, worship. He wants folks to, he gets worshipped all the time, right? He gets worshipped by, you know, like the heathen kings, as Denethor says, right? There's lots of Sauron where people make altars to Sauron, and it's not an isolated incident, right? Of course, it happens very spectacularly in Numenor, where he becomes like the high priest of Morgoth, and people are coming and worshiping him as a god. He seems to be into that more than Morgoth is, really, in some ways. Morgoth never seems to be, I mean, he wants to be held as the god of the whole world, but he's like got bigger fish to fry. Sauron seems to be perfectly happy going about and getting like tribes of men and stuff to worship him. That seems to be one of his goals. So again, I think that ultimately, I like the distinction that you're making at the beginning about Sauron not really kind of treating the elves as people. What I would say, actually, the thing that made me think of, Nick, honestly, is children, right? I mean, they're the children of Iluvatar, right?
Right.
But there are different ways that people look at children. There are many people who look at children as if they're just like, you know, they're sub-adult, right? People who just don't take children seriously and don't exactly treat them exactly like they would treat animals, but, I mean, are put them in a different category, right? Don't really take them seriously. And I mean, this is a thing that happens with adults and children, you know, you can see this. So like, basically it would be like the Valar would look at the children of Iluvatar as, you know, with love and the desire to care for them and taking them seriously, though possibly risking patronizing them, right? Possibly risking, which they do, of course, in the end. What the Valar kind of do is infantilize the elves, right? Oh, they can't make it in the big, cruel world by themselves. We must take them in and shelter them, right? And that's wrong, but wrong in a benevolent and good-hearted kind of way, right?
Noblesse oblige.
Exactly. Sauron might just kind of underrate them at first, right? Just as many adults might consider children kind of generally useless, like for adult tasks or whatever.
That does make it a little bit more delicious that, you know, he's going to get the tar beat out of him by a little girl and her dog.
It kind of does, doesn't it? Yeah, absolutely. So he doesn't take them seriously. But the thing is, I think he should come to respect them more, at least desire their worship. He wants to be king. He doesn't just and so like basically he sees that he maybe he does have standing orders about the Dark Rider thing, and maybe that's why he takes them at first. But I gotta think, I mean, he's gonna come to recognize that in Sauron's world, the ultimate role of elves and men is as his servants, subjects, and worshippers. Like, that's their natural role. And that, I think, is the role that he's going to want them to be in. Now, he's in a difficult situation, right? He's not in a time of peace, so he does need soldiers. And so if they're going to be his subjects, if they're going to be his servants, well, his primary need is in war and, you know, struggling with the Balrog. But I do think that his attitude could, if his attitude shifts, if we have a moment where he, he doesn't have, we can still get Tivildo, right? Tivildo can still take one and be tormenting it like a cat tormenting a mouse, right? You know, Tivildo could kind of catch one or be stalking one, and he could walk in on Tivildo torturing it and you know, call him off it and say, hey, like, you know, don't do that. He could even look noble. This could be a turning point for the elves, right? Where they see Sauron as their protector now.
Right.
What if Sauron is kind of is orchestrating that?
If that's also possible, we could at least leave that to doubt as to whether or not he has orchestrated that.
Yeah. Well, one thing that I do like about this is it does add a level of complexity to the Angband politicking situation. Yes. Because now Tivildo is not really same team,
right.
In the way that he was before, and he's not acting under orders. He's kind of like a cat.
Exactly.
But he's like that. He's like that powerful individual in the company that nobody really wants to deal with. But in order to get certain things done, you have to get through this person. Which, again, it does kind of give us that you know, that only sane man in the asylum vibe, where Sauron is having to manipulate all these forces and sometimes allow things that he wouldn't necessarily consider couth or moral in order to get the things done that he needs to get done. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's his step down the path towards lawful evil, whereas now he's more... Exactly. Lawful neutral.
Yeah, Sauron is the least evil. I'm not still really sure where Thorin Gwethil is, but he's the least evil of all the... I mean, Draugluin is just a tormented spirit who, you know, vents his pain and suffering on others. Tivildo is twisted. And the Balrogs are over the edge, right? They've already crossed their Rubicon of evil. Right, when they destroyed the lamps and their physical change, you know, as we described in the first season, which is still one of my favorite touches of season one, by the way. I love the archangelic Balrogs and the change.
Yeah,
I still love that. But anyway, yeah. So they are, as Marie, exactly as you just said, the Balrogs are completely fallen. Sauron is not yet completely fallen, right? I mean, and Myron, he's only one short step away from Valinor. And the step that he took it's not a big one, right? He's still in, as I said last time, he's still in that, in like where he really believes Saruman's speech, right? Nothing need change in our ends, only in our means, right? That's basically the step he's made in joining Morgoth, but he did nothing else, right? He's not crossed any other lines. He hasn't done anything super bad yet, nor are his ends super bad. He's not just trying to torture people for the fun of torturing people. He's not wanting to destroy good for the sake of destroying good. He's not opposing anything bright and beautiful wherever it is on principle. Nothing like that. He's just, he may really believe that he is the enlightened monarch who can lead Middle-earth into its period of destined glory, right? Fulfilling the vision of strength and justice that Morgoth had, and engagement with Middle-earth. And because remember, that was the ultimate divide, right, between Utumno and Valinor back in the day, halfway through season one, the choice of like, are we going to, you know, and he would be totally on Melkor's side by now on that question, right? That the whole creation of Valinor thing, the we're going to go off and hide and gaze at our navels for the rest of eternity and leave the rest of the world to go hang is obviously wrong, right? Here we, Melkor and Myron, are out here, you know, trying to make Middle-earth into what it is supposed to be, right? We are fulfilling the vision and making the music come to pass, and so he is the monarch, benevolent and wise. Now, especially now that Melkor is gone, right? He must grudgingly take on that mantle. So, I mean, this all seems to me Sauron's point of view, and so showing him to be, there might be perhaps a hesitation to show Sauron being good, but I don't think we should be hesitant to do that. I think we should show him as he's still mostly good. Right, his goals are good. His impulses are mostly good. He just is, the step that he's taken is the compromise of means. Right, willing to do unscrupulous things in order to get there.
So,
Yeah.
So maybe like okay, if I may, as like a quick kind of timeline revision here, real quick. So the standing order, the standing order from Melkor before he was taken, the standing order was to kidnap elves in the guise of the Dark Rider, so that to fool the elves into thinking that Orome was a bad dude. The standing orders were non-specific as to what to do with them once you have them.
Correct. Because Morgoth is planning to take care of that himself.
Right. He has in his own mind the setup. You know, there might even be like the machinery may actually already exist in Angband. It's just not being in use at the time. So that's possible. I'm using the word machinery very figuratively here, but
I understand.
Okay.
And he didn't even know what Morgoth was really planning to do.
Right. So he starts out kind of just holding them, okay? Mm-hmm. To Vildo, the Balrogs obviously want to kill them, and Sauron is able to prevent that. To Vildo starts getting a hold of them and messing around with them, torturing them, whatnot. Sauron steps in and starts with his own project to create the dark elves that are subservient to him personally, with the all the while of the mind that that he needs to be able to A, protect himself and his plans from the Balrogs. He needs to Vildo, so he has to kind of allow him to do things that he wants to do.
Right.
Okay. Because it's possible that Tivildo has like a whole cadre of guys that he can call on. Sauron's got nobody until
basically,
he creates.
Sauron's allowing Tivildo to sort of indulge his what Sauron considers distasteful enjoyments. Because as sort of a reward for Tivildo's loyalty and support.
Essentially. He creates the werewolves because he realizes that these elves are not going to go toe-to-toe with the Balrogs in any numbers.
Right.
I guess it's important because it shows, you know, like, despite the fact that we're, you know, it shows that sort of deep down for him, ultimately, even though we're portraying him as somewhat benevolent at this point, like, you know, well, he would never himself go and torture the elves or warp them or whatever, that at the end of the day, the elves to him are still tools. They're still means to an end. So if he has to throw some of them to the cat, as it were, he doesn't mind.
Right. Well, I mean, think about the reasons why people do evil things, at least in the beginning. People do evil things because they have orders. People do evil things because they had no other choice. People do evil things, people allow evil things to take place. They're not doing them personally, but they're allowing them because either they have no other choice or they don't have the power to do anything about it in their minds.
Right.
That's how evil happens. Those are the reasons that evil happens. Not very rarely does somebody get up in the morning and say, I'm going to do evil today. That's just, you know, people
Do evil for evil's sake, yes.
Right. There are people like that, and they're called sociopaths, but, you know, they're very few and far between, or somebody who has just gone down the road of doing evil for so long that that's just what they do.
Yeah. And actually, this brings Mike, I'm not going to answer this question, but I wanted to mention this. Mike Huckstad has just said, looking forward, what is Sauron's breaking the lamps moment, right? At what point? I mean, if the breaking of the lamps was the point to which the Balrogs became completely fallen, they crossed that line. I've argued that Melkor crosses that line at the destruction of the lamps, the moment we get with him at the end of episode 13 is really a fall. I mean, you know, he's really crossed the line at that point. When does it happen with Sauron? And it's a wonderful question because honestly, in the given history of Sauron that we have, the only thing that I could would be Numenor, essentially. The fall of Numenor would be the parallel moment.
He's pretty far gone by the time we get to Beren and Luthien, though.
Well, see, that's the question, though, because I don't even know. It's. I think we could, first of all, if there's one character that we have to play the long game on, it's Sauron, right? I mean, he's our antagonist for like 20 years, so we don't have to hustle him down the road to evil. He's got plenty of time to go down it at his own leisure. And of course, I'm not saying that he shouldn't go down it, or we should make him repent or something, or undermine the things that he does in Middle Earth during the, but we don't know of them. I mean, the incident with Beren and Luthien is just about the only time. No, it is the only time that he's mentioned.
What about, could he be responsible for the deaths of Barahir and his band?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. No, he,
because if he is, we could essentially do that, and A, it sets him up as the antagonist, as a main antagonist of Beren and Luthien during their story, and it also it gives him that kind of event horizon moment.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I don't, and Maria's reminding us, of course, that he does, as she says, pseudo-repent at the end of the First Age. Yeah. And, you know, and Maria, remember, it is said that he meant it. I mean, there's the possibility of real repentance there, and I like that. I mean, if the trajectory of Sauron's character includes a real, though temporary and not wholehearted, repentance at the end of the First Age, and then we get to show him relapsing. Right? We get to show the progress of the repentant Sauron through to the fall of Numenor, right? And that's when he... So actually, I think I'm right about the fall of Numenor. Until the fall of Numenor, Sauron's repentance needs to still be in play. Because he's going to repent, right? And not just to deceive the Valar, but he's gonna really mean it when he repents. It's not going to stick, but he's going to really mean it. When he repents at the end of the First Age. And he's got to, that's got to still be possible. And then, so then even his empire building among humans after, in the Second Age, right? Leading up to Numenor, to the Numenor incident, needs to be not like, and now, like, I shall twirl my mustache and cackle maniacally as I build a kingdom of evil. But, you know, again, sort of a slow slide, probably through similar patterns of putting means before ends, that in the end he ends up going to Numenor and becoming worshipped as a god and then ultimately falling off the cliff. So I like it. I mean, I think it's... Yeah. So having him not be completely fallen in the First Age, I think would be really good.
You know what this means is it kind of gives him an out for his defeat at the hands of Luthien, because what it's really just a lack of resolve.
That's right. Yeah.
To kill an unarmed girl.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. He was sparing her benevolently. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
At least in his own mind.
In his own mind. Exactly.
He wasn't defeated. He just was like, well, this isn't worth it.
Yeah, exactly. And now Lincoln asks the great question, you know, can he still be responsible for the deaths of Barahir and his band without having a breaking of the lamps moment? Cue the kicking of the can side effect or sound effect. That is a season 5 question, my friend, and we are not going to answer that right now. All I am saying, I'm not going to write Sauron's story for the next 10 seasons, but I am just going to say, his story is going to be interesting, and I do think we can have him not wholly fallen, not wholly ruined yet.
I think that's the way to make it interesting.
Yeah,
I was only following orders.
He's going to be following orders, right? But what exactly is his relationship with Morgoth going to be? And what kind of service is he going to do? Frankly, I am interested. He only gets mentioned in the Beren and Luthien story, but there is no reason to think he's not involved in other stuff that happens, right? And I am not going to want to leave him behind, especially since, of course, as we know, he's going to be our main antagonist
all the way through. I don't want to leave him behind. I'm wanting to hang with Sauron. I want Sauron to be one of our most persistent characters through the entire story.
Well, he probably gets sent out to the frontier because he's such a, you know, like Melkor knows he can't necessarily depend on him to make the evil choice at the right time.
He's unreliably evil, right? Yeah. I like you, Myron, but really just sometimes you flake out and you do good things. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. But anyway, yeah, this is great stuff and yeah, it's going to be fun. It's really going to be fun. But that's a future occasion. For now, I just glancing towards all of that complexity to come and wanting to preserve all that complexity to come. I do want to have him come around to being, and because of course, notice we have potential conflict with Morgoth coming in right away, right? That he had his orders, which was to go and masquerade as the Black Rider and kidnap elves. And he might, in a sense, repent it, or at least be like, you know, I'm sorry I did that, or this is not, you know, now I want to win them over. You know, now I have a different plan now. I've got to make a different plan now because Morgoth is gone, right? So I'm gonna stop the Dark Rider shtick, and I'm gonna start the you know, being a benevolent and wise wizard king, the Lord of Gloaming. I'm gonna go with the Lord of Gloaming instead, and he has a different relationship with the elves. Though we can still see, as with Tivildo, I still do think that Tivildo scene can be really pivotal because it can show us like he doesn't actually care about them that much. Ultimately, his interest in the elves is self-serving, and he's willing to sacrifice them, as you say, in order to keep Tivildo, well, I won't say happy, but anyway, okay. So everyone's all obsessing about like the episodes we're supposed to be discussing. This is good material, folks. Anyway,
yes, so episode 5.
This was all relevant to episode 5, in a big sense. So because episode 5 is where the werewolves and the Balrogs elf hunting came in. By the way, the thing that I really loved about the elf hunting Balrogs scene, which involved the conflict with Ase and Uinen, I love the intervention of Ase and Uinen, because of course Ase and Uinen are two of the Ainur who are most willing to intercede on the part of the children of Iluvatar, and they're the ones who do it most frequently, especially Uinen, of course. We know of her blessing to the Numenoreans, and that, by the way, was a genius stroke that you guys had, because we had talked about Círdan and Ase, right, and them kind of buddying up in this episode. I love the touch that you guys added of how Uinen and Olwë become friends at the same time. I thought that was absolutely brilliant. As you know, Olwë as like the first of the Mariner kings, right? The maker of ships, and so setting her out from the very beginning as the protector of ships and shipmakers, I think is great. I really loved that. So we can being able to kind of parallel that, in a sense she is protecting the Numenoreans. Even her protection of her relationship with the Numenoreans is like sort of connected to and derived from this in some senses. I like it, or at least parallel to it. I thought that was really cool. I loved that. Oh, but one small point I wanted to, and again, it's a good point. In the outline of episode 5, you guys were talking about the Balrogs being attacked essentially at a water crossing, right? And I love that because, of course, water crossings are going to be a big deal, like all the way down to the Ringwraiths who are scared to cross water. Right. And it's a big question. I mean, I was just asked that wonderful question When I had my interview with the extremely precocious,
I remember
Maggie during the webathon, and she asked that question: why are the Ringwraiths afraid to cross water? It's never explained. I mean, Tolkien doesn't say why they're afraid to cross
and
water.
And now we know.
And now we know, right? I mean, if
because Unin could randomly pop up,
right,
and ruin your day.
You just know. I mean, between Olmo, right, who goes his own way and is willing to do stuff without the approval of all the rest of the Valar, and Ossé and Uinen, who are completely loose cannons, like, water is just pretty darn unpredictable, and you never know what's going to happen, especially, you know, if you're evil. So, yeah, absolutely. I love that. I thought that touch was really cool. And yeah, Marie, exactly. Marie says Uinen is going to wreck stuff after the kinslaying. Absolutely. She totally is. And yeah, and so yes, if Olwë dies there and their friends, no, Marie, exactly. That's what I was thinking. And it's why I loved that whole thing, especially since we're not going to be able to get, there's only so much we're going to be able to do in building up, you know, like, characters to, like, who's going to lament Olwë? Right. I mean, yeah, Olwë is, you know, Thingol is, but we're not going to be able to have anyone survive him because we're going to leave the Teleri behind. Right. But we'll still have Uinen. Right. We'll always have Uinen, who will remember the kinslaying and be able to speak against it and against the Noldor. So anyway, yeah, loved it. Loved it. I know we do have his daughter, but, you know, and she's important for genealogical reasons and everything. But anyway, I liked it.
He'll be fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
He'll get better.
Yeah. Yeah. The dreams, I was a big fan of the dreams, of Olwë and Círdan. Because again, that's another really nice theme to introduce here. You know, the idea of sort of the prophetic dream. We've already had it with Lenwë. And did we decide to put the dream into episode 4? Do we still have it in episode 3? Did we make a decision about that last time? I know we were talking about, I wanted to change that so that, like, the significance of it didn't become clear until the next episode. And we didn't necessarily show it on screen, but had him talk about it.
Yeah, having him talk about it in episode 3 makes sense, especially if he just describes it as a tree talking. He doesn't remember what it was going to say, but he there's something, we have a purpose. There's something that we have to do, and he could even say it lies to the west, mm-hmm. which they're going to run into the Ents to the west.
Right. Exactly.
So that makes sense.
Yeah, I love that, actually, because, of course, obviously everyone assumes, even himself presumably assumes, that when he says his destiny lies, you know, his purpose lies in the West, that it's Valinor, right? And again, I love that because that really spotlights the difference that I was trying to insist on last time, the difference between the Avari who say we won't go and Lenwë who says, no, this is where my purpose is. So yeah, he's gotten to the west. Not quite as far west as everybody else thought he was going to go, right? But he's gone west, and he has found his purpose. So yeah, love that.
This is my stop.
That's right. This is my stop. This is where I get off. Exactly. The dreams of Olwë and Círdan, do we want to show those, or do we want to – because they're kind of image – I mean, I kind of feel like unless we're going to get, you know, voiceover or dialogue or something like that I'm not sure we need to depict to show the dreams on screen. They can just speak of them.
Well,
to each other.
Here's the thing. If you show them, like, you can, what we had kind of envisioned was actually intercutting,
right,
their dreams. You'd obviously have to have, like, different color schemes and stuff so you could realize whose dream we were in,
right,
at any given moment.
Dreams, like it.
Right. Well, so that you didn't think that they were having a tandem dream,
right,
in some weird way. But I feel like having the imagery is going to be very, very powerful, so that when we see the swan ships, we immediately think back to the dream. When we see Arendelle's ship,
yes,
if we can remember this far back,
right,
we should be thinking of this dream. So I would really like to see that, this intercutting dream sequence, with plenty of music. I wouldn't do any voiceover. I don't think we need to, and I don't think we need to shy away from it either. So.
Right. Yeah, I mean, like, for instance, later on, obviously, you know, when we get the dreams of Finrod and Turgon, right? The dreams that we do Nargothrond and Gondolin, we'll need voiceover there. They're receiving a message, right? And it's a rather specific message. Including, I mean, Turgon receives a very specific message about the armor that he's supposed to leave behind and all that kind of thing, right? So so we're definitely going to need dialogue there.
Are we going to have Ulmo give Tours measurements during the dream sequence?
No, he does. Exactly, right.
Yeah. I know he does. But...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I've designed it. I've written it. Yes, exactly. This is the measurements that you're going to need. Exactly. And you're right about the visual imagery. Because, I mean, think about the way that can be. We can start with an image of a living swan. And if that image can be visually juxtaposed so that we can see it in the swan ships, right? So when we see the swan ships at Aqualondë, when we see them arriving at Aqualondë, there can be a parallel between the swan in Always Dream, the swan ships as they arrive at the shores of Valinor, and the swan ships as they are burning in season 3. And have those all tied together by the one parallel image of the swan would be really cool. Because that really puts forward the swan's, you know, this image of the swan is evocative of Always Purpose. And ultimately, Always Purpose is thwarted by Feanor and the Noldor in the theft and then destruction of his great work.
At least almost purpose for him.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it does help to convey the real tragedy of that, which I think is really good. With Círdan, I love Vingolat as a thing in the dream. I think it would seem to me that with Círdan, we're going to need a series of images, the last of which will be Vingolat, right? If all he gets is Vingolat, that's way too long to wait for the payoff.
Right, and it's a little heavy-handed too.
It is. But I love the idea of that being the last image. You know,
yes.
The greatest ship that he will ever make. But what other images would Círdan have? Other models of other ships that come.
Other ships, of course, yes.
What does he do? He's a shipwright. Right.
Yeah. Although one thing about Vingolat, I can't pronounce that word.
Vingolat. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. One thing about that, it would be really cool. It might be a little heavy-handed, but it would be really cool if you just saw like a single dove flying over it also.
Yes. Yes. Or a seagull. Is she going to be a seagull? Or an albatross?
Not an albatross. They're a little clumsy. But yeah, I could see a gull or a tern or something. Terns are a little bit more graceful and
tern.
Kind of a
rat. Anybody who's lived on the coast like I have, you know, fully agrees with the Finding Nemo statement that that gulls are rats with wings.
Right. Right.
Yes. Yes. Might. But yeah. I can foreshadow the swan that oh my god, I just
two or swans.
Blanked on her name. No, Arendelle's wife.
Elwing.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of, yes.
Exactly.
She changes into a white bird. I don't remember if there was a specific bird. But anyway, as to other images, we could see. I feel like seeing the Havens might be a little bit too heavy-handed, maybe.
Right. We don't want it to be. I mean, if it's
it would be obvious.
Yeah, exactly. It can't be like instructions. Like, here are the architectural specs of the Haven you're supposed
right,
to build.
Right. Exactly.
And here are the different models of ships you're going to work yourself through.
Vingolat
should really be the only explicit. Maybe we just have one image is the seabird,
right? And we don't know what that means. I mean, an L-wing is one of the things, of course, that it's going to evoke eventually, but it could be more things. Some other things which suggest his purpose.
Could we see? Okay. All right. What we could see is we could see like a flock of gulls on the sea near the shore. Okay? Near the western shore of Middle Earth, essentially. And see them heading west on the water and then taking off and flying up. Although Omul doesn't know that Valinor is going to be removed from Middle Earth. So I don't know if that works. You know what I'm going for, right?
Yeah.
Or he may know, because he has a better understanding of where the music's going in total than everybody else.
Right.
So he may at least have... He may not consciously know, but he may at some level know.
The problem with all this is that Kierden plays such a small role in the events of the First Age.
And right.
Plays such a narrow role at all times. Right? I mean, he's kind of a one-trick pony, really. But seeing him as, you know, Maria, as you're suggesting, seeing him as a kind of protector, right, of the Teleri still in Middle-earth. I've got this in my head again because I've been reading the Book of Lost Tales lately. But I'm thinking of the Alora Male, the Path of Dreams. This is an idea that Tolkien abandoned after the Lost Tales, apparently. But it's basically the rainbow and this idea of like the Path of Dreams where human children come to Valinor in their dreams. But the idea of it, when the Alora Male is constructed, it's a pathway after the hiding of Valinor in order to enable still a connection between Valinor. So Valinor is almost entirely removed, like it's made almost completely and almost perfectly inaccessible from the rest of the world, but the Alora Male is still this golden thread which connects Valinor and Middle Earth. And that's kind of Círdan's job, right? You know, Valinor is almost totally inaccessible, not to bring human children in their dreams to Valinor, but he is the Alora Male, right? I mean, he is that one single bridge, you know, that one narrow, delicate bridge that still connects Valinor and Middle Earth. And that's his, I would think that's his purpose in a nutshell. Like, he is to be that connection. He is the keeper of the straight road later on after the bending of the world and the fall of Numenor. Like, he's the dude who has the key, you know, who has the, you know, the access to the straight road.
Okay. What if he's standing on the beach and he has a bird in his hand? Okay. And he walks up to the sea and he can see the gull. I hadn't heard of this before, but I really like this. He sees the golden thread in the sea leading off to the horizon in the west. And he releases this bird, and it flies off following the thread. That's essentially what he does.
Yeah, that image of a bird being released and flying, like his hands releasing a bird and it flying off into the west, I like that image. I still think it should be a collection of images. It shouldn't be negative.
Yeah. Right.
But if we have... And it's okay if it's inscrutable. Like, it's not supposed to be something that's easily understood. There can be an image of the, you know, the I mean, I don't know if we show something that really looks like the Alora Male, which was basically the rainbow. I mean, that's what it was in the Book of Lost Tales. So it's in the sky.
It's like the rainbow road to Asgard.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's
the rainbow bridge.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we could show a rainbow. You know, we could show that could be one of the images that we show, for instance. And it's okay if it doesn't make sense. You know, it doesn't make perfect sense. It doesn't have to be totally intelligible at that point. But yeah, so the images of him, something to connect him to the rest of his people, maybe a glimpse of some of the other people like that were left behind. Maybe we get a little
some of the Avari,
like Teleri montage, right? The you know, some of the Avari, Lenway's folks, people of you know, Sindar.
Not Elway, because they think he's dead.
Right. No, the folks hunting for Elway. I was thinking.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
And you know, so we just get brief images, right? Montage images of them, and then like that image of him releasing the bird, and then the rainbow, and then Vingalot ultimately at the end. That kind of thing, I think, could work. And yet, Maurice is obviously cured and has never seen sunlight or a rainbow before. Yeah, Marie, you're right. Even just like a bright blue sky would be quite a vision, right? Which would be an inexplicable vision, really. So yeah, the idea of like a distant rainbow in a blue sky would be an incredible and inexplicable vision. So yeah, I like that.
Oh, you know what you just made me realize? That even with the in the lay of the trees, the sky over Valinor is never blue.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Yeah. Yeah. Changes your vision of what's supposed to
be. Well, no, we just did a session specifically with stuff like that, and I should have thought of that then. But there was things like that we were trying to figure out, like different how the air quotes economy of Valinor works and stuff like that, but should have been something that came up, and I'm kicking myself for not thinking of it then.
And by the way, I the other thing that I want to say, and then I'm like moving on because efficiency
to episode
is
6
name, I like the parallel between Arwen and like and Olwey / Círdan. I thought that was the way that the frame kind of suggests that, you know, that because she's really, in a sense, those are the two things that she's kind of poised between, right? She is clearly focused on purpose and trying to figure out, like, and it's one of the things, I mean, this is in the frame, this is Arwen becoming reconciled with the choice of her friend, right? And in a sense, the visions of Olwey and Círdan really help with that, because they show like they're both of them have a different purpose, one in Valinor and one here, and that's okay, right? Different people have different callings and different jobs, and that's all right. And so, you know, having her kind of coming to kind of be at peace with that, and her own, you know, her own sense of purpose, and still not being sure what her own purpose is. At the very least, I mean, one of the things that I think that this helps, you know, what some of the progress that Arwen and hopefully the viewers as well have made at this point is that basically her fear at the beginning seems to be that going off into the West is merely a cop out. Right. If the elves' purpose is to be in the West, then remaining in Middle-earth is mere delinquency. If the elves' purpose is in Middle-earth, then going to the West is escapism. Right. And so the first step that she has in understanding this question and how it applies to her is, no, that's not necessarily the case. Right. And Olwey and Círdan, I think, represent that really, really well. I think that's really cool. So anyway, I like that. All right.
So episode 6.
Episode 6. Yeah, here we are. So, so Muriel's pregnant, right?
Yes.
And, she's one of the, what you're thinking of is probably the protagonist of this episode.
Yes.
I said before in episode 3 that I love the sundering of Muriel from the rest of her family, right? How most of her family chooses to remain and be Avari. I loved that. And I loved it twice as much when we get here. And the idea that like her why is she so focused on her fetus, right? Why is she so obsessed with, and you know, how alone, I mean, apart from Finway, how alone she is, right?
Yeah.
And the idea of, like, how this kind of connects with her lost family and not to mention all the delays, right? The delay of her marriage with Finway. Like, she's been wanting to have a child for a long time. So I love that element, you know, that how this is you know, sort of fulfilling a long delayed life goal for her, and then you have the grief for her family, and I love all that. I thought that worked really well.
There is something that I wanted to talk about in Act Three, real quick.
Okay.
About because as I'm looking at the outline. The reasons why we did certain things here are not super clear, so I kind of wanted to address that. So we had an issue right off the bat with, and you guys had talked about this as well, about why the Sindar are willing to accept this weird lady who comes out of the woods with Elway, who's been missing for untold centuries.
Right.
You know, they show up and he's like, hey, meet Melian. She's great. She's going to be my wife and our queen. And now instead of going to Valinor, we're going to stay here. It looks weird. Right. Right.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we talked about that. How, like,
right. I remember. Yeah.
Sketchy
yeah.
lady in the woods. Right.
Right. Like, so we had to find a way. We had to find a way to very, very quickly warm them up to her.
Right.
And so what we did with that was to tie. We tied the bad guy story element into this moment. So Elway's guys who have been searching for him are set upon by werewolves that Sauron created last episode.
Right.
I think.
Yeah. Correct.
And Elway and Melian come out. And the werewolves are essentially dispelled, you know. And like Melian shows up, and they're like, "Yeah, we don't want any of this." And Melian heals one of the wounded, so like she's clearly a good guy.
Yes,
in the eyes of the elves, we know, we've known this whole time.
Yeah,
the viewer knows that she's okay, but to convince the elves, right. But to convince the elves as quickly as possible that she's all right, we get that, and that also ties us back to the Angband scene where Drogolun comes in with his report of what's going on, and instead of in the outline, Sauron is dabbling with orc creation. What he could be doing is in fact being among his dark elf dudes, if that's the way we're going with that.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, I just wanted to throw that out there because I'm looking at it, I'm like, this isn't really clear why this is happening this way.
Right. Right. And it's not just like, let's add a random action sequence. No.
Right. Yeah. I always feel compelled to explain action scenes when they come up. I don't know why that happens, but.
Right. Well, I mean, so many people accuse Peter Jackson of that. It's totally understandable. I am always strongly in defense of it, not of just random action for the sake of action, but I, you know, action sequences can be really wonderful ways to convey stuff, you know, to convey plot and character development.
And quickly.
And I think, but I personally, I think this is a brilliant way to do this, because if you think about the way it's described in the books, right, nobody who comes before Melian has any doubt about who she is. Right. Like, just being in the presence of Melian and looking in her face is enough to show you, like, to change you, even. Beren is affected, right, when he's brought before Melian. It's like what happens to Gimli with Galadriel, right? He distrusts elves and, you know, and he has no love for the elves of Lothlorien, and then he stands before Galadriel and no further questions, right? Just being in her presence is enough to inspire him with that sort of level of confidence. But that's really hard to depict on screen. And the problem, I mean, like, the issue that happens and inevitably happens. Like, it makes it on screen. Jackson's film, and again, I can't blame him. I mean, I like the way he did it, and I like what he was trying to do. But inevitably, people think
Gimli's all sheepish.
Well, and they make it looks like a romantic infatuation, right? Like he's got the hots for Galadriel, you know. And it's not exactly that. It's not exactly not that either. But it's not exactly
it's not
that.
Right. It's not entirely untrue, but
no, but it's not.
I mean, he does nearly murder Aemir over it. So
exactly.
Well,
but that's
it's really evocative of chivalric love.
Exactly.
I
mean,
yes.
The sort of idealized version, not the actual courtly love version where you were actually
right.
Exactly. But yeah. No, exactly. It's she becomes his ideal.
Right.
But there's no sexual element. I mean, he doesn't want to sleep with her. I don't think he's even tempted in that way. It's not the way it works. But that anyway, my point is the way you're doing it is much better. Because what you are doing is creating a situation on screen where it is impressed upon everyone, the other elves, and upon the viewers, that she is... And what better way than to show evil actually just fleeing from her, right? She shows up and evil can't... You know, the creature, especially the werewolves, great choice, by the way, right? Because they are the product of evil, right? Of, you know, they're like the most evil thing Sauron has done, actually, to this point. And they themselves are twisted and violent, and they can't stand in front of her, right? So just showing that, so she just like repels them. I'm thinking maybe she even fixes them. If we see Sauron imprisoning spirits within the bodies of wolves, maybe she releases their spirits. And so she like.
Well, some of them do have to get away in order to tell the story.
No, exactly,
but yes,
exactly. But the ones that are closest, she wouldn't destroy them or she wouldn't kill them, but she sets them free.
Yeah.
And Drogluin could report this. Of course, he would be probably deeply creeped out by the whole thing,
From his point of view, it could look very much like she just straight up killed them.
Just destroyed them.
That's
absolutely
true.
But if we had some, well, anyway, I don't want to get too far into the details. But yes, I love this. I think that does that job really, really well, of sort of showing, and so they would take her as their queen immediately. Or they wouldn't need Thingol's recommendation at that point.
Right, you know? Right.
Showing them, like, all, you know, like, dropping to one knee in front of her.
So he comes
out
and he says, oh, I see you've met the missus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly,
So now,
you've met the
about the main plot of the episode.
Mm-hmm. The Muriel plot.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I was. Hey, you're the one who changed the subject. I was.
No. I totally take responsibility for that. I just happened to see it, and I wanted to talk about it before it became an issue later.
I was wondering if we wanted to sort of show that we had talked about like the how the what was cloaking them, right? What was blocking the. What was preventing anybody from finding Thingol and Melian was the like sort of little proto girdle that she's putting around Nan Elmoth there. If we wanted to start off by showing that, you know, they're running from the werewolves, right? The werewolves are pursuing them and they find themselves at Nan Elmoth and they're like, oh, dang.
Right? Not again. Not this again.
We're at the scary impenetrable forest. So their backs are to the scary impenetrable forest and their faces are to the werewolves who have been pursuing them. And we can show maybe the reluctance of the werewolves to cut. So they're at a kind of stand. I don't know. I mean, there are ways in which we could kind of play with that.
Yeah. No, I like that. That's a good idea.
But anyway, okay, so back to Muriel. Visions. She has the visions, right? Can we review the visions a little bit? So she has the visions and she's telling Indis. Did we ever solve, or excuse me, did you ever solve the question of whether or not Finwë knows about the prophecy about Fëanor?
We decided that it's better... It's better that he not know.
He not know.
That he not know that Muriel has concerns.
Right.
Because it's going to, like, he's got enough going on. He's got enough reason to be a bad parent. like, it's going to color his raising of this child in ways that we don't necessarily...
Right.
Don't necessarily want. We want him doting on Feanor. The entire time, and not in a, oh, I feel so bad, I don't want to raise up the new Melkor. Like, that's not the vibe we want to get from that.
Yeah. You want his view unclouded.
Right. Right.
Right. Right. But Indus knows.
Indus knows.
Indus knows.
Yes.
Right. Okay.
Yes.
So we're going to have scenes of her. So that's how the viewer knows about it. So the viewer is going to. So basically, we're showing Muriel here in a state of denial, essentially.
That happens during the birth. She gets the negative. Like, everything that she gets up until that point is super positive, which is one of the reasons why she's putting forth more and more effort, right? It's not until the birth itself that she starts getting the negative visions.
Right. Now,
which isn't
somebody, and I would think it's got to be, somebody would have to, and I would think it would have to be Indus. Somebody has to come to Muriel during the pregnancy and be like, this is a bad idea. Not the pregnancy, but like, what are you doing? Like, what? Because she's made a choice, right? I mean, it's Muriel's, Muriel is deliberately pouring her spirit out into Feanor to try to make the, and again, I love how that with the whole like childbearing as dream deferred mingled with grief for family lost. Right. And her pouring all of herself into this child who is going to be, you know, fill this hole that has always been in, or has been in her life now for so long. I love the way that all that works. I think you guys have set up a really interesting psychological framework for Muriel, why she does what she does, in a way that I think.
So
people...
did we talk about? We didn't actually talk about that, did we? That's an awesome idea.
No, we didn't talk about that.
Her motivation to pour her energy is as a result of the vision, right?
Yeah. Well, and
she sees
and
the vision.
Influence
of...
It doesn't start out with that. It starts out as she's. She's all alone. She's got nobody besides her husband, and her one could possibly presume new friend Indus. They've made friends on the journey, presumably.
Right.
They may not have traveled in the same circles before. In addition to that, she's been wanting a child since before the ambassadors left Quai Vianen.
Right.
Like, she's been looking forward to this for a very, very, very long time.
Centuries and centuries, yes.
Right. I'm thinking of, for some reason, it's not the same, but I'm thinking of Marissa Tomei in My Cousin Vinny stamping on the porch.
Right. Right.
Obviously, her biological clock is not ticking, but...
Well, they tick very slowly in any case, yeah.
Yes. Anyway, so... So it starts off as that. When she gets, as the pregnancy continues and she starts to get these visions, then it does increase it. But I wouldn't want to make the visions be the cause.
Yeah. Right.
The initial cause.
Exactly.
That makes sense.
But here's the other thing. There are two factors involved here, right? One is her own sense of, you know, loss and wanting to sort of, but the other is an older an impulse, right?
Yes, the creative impulse.
Yeah, her baby is like this, you know, her baby is to Muriel what the Silmarils are to Feanor, you know, and the Swan Ships are to Olwë, frankly, right? I mean, it's her masterwork. And she's making the best baby that's ever been made, right? And it's like it's not exactly craftsmanship, of course, in the same way, but the motivation is similar. Right, I mean, this is her masterwork, the work that she will never be able to do again, and she recognizes that. She's okay with making the choice to pour a bunch of herself into her kid, knowing that it's going to be the only one, and knowing that that's not what her husband wants. But it's okay, but, you know, it's okay. Because
boy, that makes the visions, as far as the unsettling visions, even sadder.
It does. Though the initial visions of greatness confirm her and egg her on
exactly.
in this.
Yes,
right. It's like a confirmation that it's she's right tragic, to do what she wants to do. Yeah. And so, what we can set up is a parallel with Feanor, because I mean, it's a parallel that's going to happen three episodes from now, right? With the Silmarils. When Feanor is making the Silmarils and Nerdanel is like, dude, are you, you know, what are you doing? Like, are you sure this is okay? But we need somebody in the Nerdanel position with her. And I think it's got to be Indis.
Yeah.
Right. Finwë is in the kind of dopey husband role at this point with, as far as the pregnancy is concerned. Right.
As men typically tend to occupy exactly. that role. That makes perfect sense.
That's not hard. Right. And yeah, he's cheerfully nattering on about, like, you know, how many kids they're going
to
have.
Oh, he's going to teach his kid how to play baseball, and yeah,
right, exactly. And he's gonna, you know, he's looking forward to like making a whole baseball team, and
teach him how to design cities, and
exactly,
yeah.
It's going
to
be awesome. And meanwhile, she's like, you know, she doesn't argue with him, but she knows it's different. Right. So Indis is the only other person it can be, right? So she has to have conversations with Indis, in which Indis cautions her. Doesn't say what you're doing is awful, but like, be careful. You can put too much of yourself into it. If she's saying that there, this can give greater resonance to when Nerdanel says that to Feanor in episode 9.
Yes. I agree.
You know,
and one thing, this is a little bit of a tangent, but we somehow kind of discovered that while Feanor is obviously the greater craftsman, Finwë might be the better architect between him and his son. Okay. It comes up in episode 10, but it just occurred to me just now.
Having
but,
something that Finwë is like known for would be good.
Yeah,
because Finwë could easily become such a cipher, and known only for weakness, essentially.
Yes.
So yeah, I like that. I mean, there should be, if he's the High King of the Noldor, he has to be. He should be superlative in some art or other, right?
Yes. Clearly.
I like that. I like that. So as long as we can have those running so there should be concern. There should be alarm. Prior to so that the because of course another thing that I was thinking when reading through this was the whole concern about the pregnancy and is the delivery going to go okay, that shouldn't be much of like, you know, mortality and childbirth is not really a thing with the elves,
right. Well, that's that we wanted to make sure that during the birth we were drawing attention to the fact, because I mean, like, you can't just show like her screaming in pain and expect people to get that something weird's going on, because
it's normal. We know to scream in pain,
right? Yeah. So we have to have people saying this is different. This is weird. Something is wrong.
Yes.
She shouldn't be in this much pain.
She shouldn't. Yes. Exactly. Exactly. And if we have lots of ominous foreshadowing between the combination of Indis just sort of in her concern with what she sees her friend doing and the increasingly sort of disturbing visions or unease that Muriel is getting, though probably not admitting to herself, and trying to downplay to Indis, then that, of course, builds the tension around the birth. Last thing I want to talk about here. So I love all this stuff, and I think this stuff is going to be really good. And as I've said, I mean this plays on the stuff before with Vire, which, as I said, I love every moment that Vire comes onto the scene in your outlines. They're great. I love the way that this fulfilling that tableau that Finwë saw when he was an ambassador, right? Of the two of them and a baby there in Lorien. But of course, it's overlaid with tragedy when we finally get there, which he doesn't realize at first. Just love all that stuff. The last thing I want to talk about is the her death,
which we don't actually really show.
Well, You have a death scene, like the "Don't Hold Me Accountable."
Yeah, I know, I know, but that's more of a like a final goodbye to Finway.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. The
goodbye. It is for all intents and purposes, it is her death scene, but she's not.
Right.
She's not dead at the end of.
Yeah, exactly. We're not. There's yeah, no corpse. But my question is, does why? Why does she, like, how does her, cause she, what, kind of gives up? She, why does she do what she does? Why doesn't she, is it really impossible?
There's a couple of things. One, she is exhausted. She's done with life. She can't, she literally can't even.
Right. right. Right.
However, it's a little bit more than that, because during the birth, she's getting all these visions of fire and horribleness.
Yes.
Which she has confessed to Indus.
Yes.
And she basically is also afraid that she's given birth to a supervillain, essentially.
Right. Right. She has a sinking feeling.
Right, and she just can't watch this little boy that she loves dearly become Dr. Von Doom, essentially. Right.
So she is, she basically has, so to Finway, she speaks as if what she did was essentially self-sacrifice, right? She has poured herself out into their son, and she has given all of herself, and there's, and left not enough for herself. In fact, her words could prefigure Gilrine's words, actually.
Right.
But anyway,
yes.
Marie, as Marie says, she doesn't want to look on what she has done, right? So mm-hmm. there's, you could look at Muriel's action as an act of self-sacrifice, right? But you could also look at it as a cop out, right? As despair.
Craven. Yeah, it's a little bit of a craven.
It
yeah,
is.
Absolutely.
It is.
It is a little bit. Yeah.
And so basically, I think we could have her show one face to Finway and the other to Indus, right? Where we can see, and Indus could even sort of gently say, like, "Are you going to just give up in despair? Are you just going to run away from the consequences of what you've done?" So that we know that this is a tricky, and then, yeah. So I think as long as we show that, but then last question, there's an obvious parallel, which from a distance is awesome, right? Between Celebrian's situation and Muriel's, right? The whole, like, I can't find healing for myself situation. But obviously the parallel is potentially unsettling, going the way that we're going with Muriel's character, which seems great and almost inevitable. But it's going to really color. If in the frame we're showing Arwen is at peace with Celebrian's choice, you know, that she couldn't find healing in Middle-earth and really had to go to Valinor, that's the parallel doesn't work with Muriel, right? Because in the end, I think we'd have to say the story.
Unless Arwen's wrong.
Certainly, at the end of the day, Muriel failed. She was wrong to do what she did, and she failed. We don't want to say that about Celebrian, do we? Or suggest that about Celebrian?
Well, in a way, what Celebrian does do when she leaves Middle-earth, in a way, it's. It is a giving in to despair, in a way. Could she have gotten better over time? We don't know.
Right. Right.
We just know that she didn't, and that she didn't find any healing here in Middle Earth and left.
Right.
But you could make the case that, well, maybe she should have hung in a little bit longer.
Yeah,
you know, we don't know. So there is. I feel like you can kind of go either way on that. I wouldn't want to hit it too hard because you have to feel pity for a person in that situation. You know, it's not exactly like a suicide, but
right. No, no. Exactly. But it is. It's especially complex, as Marie was just pointing out. You know, that remember the sort of. It's going to be hard for people not to think about postpartum depression. I mean, any woman who has suffered from postpartum right. depression is going to be, you know, kind of relating to Muriel here in her,
yeah,
in her despair.
Yeah, of course. Of course. Well, and the thing is that you don't, like, you can have mercy on somebody, like, in your judgment of them, mm-hmm. understanding that maybe they just couldn't do any better.
Yeah.
themselves,
yeah.
you know, and that's okay. That doesn't make them an evil, horrible person. Muriel is not a terrible person for this choice that she's making. She's making a wrong choice, but it's easy for us to kind of armchair quarterback that,
yeah.
in a way.
Well, exactly, and it's the thing. I mean, in one of the ways, like, this is the Silmarillion, right? And the Silmarillion,
right?
It's not we can't shy away from. Showing people in very difficult situations making wrong choices, because that's
right.
what happens, you know.
Right.
And yeah, like, we can sympathize with Muriel. I think you guys have done a great job of setting her up as a really sympathetic character. But that doesn't change the fact that at the end of the day, she was wrong. You know, she
right.
she did not do it well, and that's okay. Like, that's good. I mean, that's you know, we can't. You can't be namby-pamby about that.
Right.
But, yeah, so maybe kind of holding it ambiguous at the end of the episode, right, about Calibrian,
yeah.
that is to say, right, where she, Arwen is kind of at peace with it, or she's sort of, you know, but it's still kind of an open question. Does this suggest that Calibrian was wrong to leave Middle-earth? Well, I think it's a very debatable subject, right? Maybe she did give up.
Right.
Maybe it was wrong.
Right.
I don't know.
But at the very least, Arwen can at least come to an understanding that her mother did the best that she could.
Right, right, exactly. Okay, all right. Well, we're roaring through what
yep.
episode 7 now. No problems. I like the Indus Feanor conflict. I think that's really good.
This was definitely a tough one.
It is a tough one.
I remember this being a very, very difficult to.
Yeah. Yeah, I can easily believe that. There are the biggest problem that I can see. The biggest problem that I can see in this episode is, and this is not our fault. This is Tolkien's fault, flat up, no question. Tolkien gave us this problem, and we have to figure out a way to deal with it. The second marriage. How does Indus overcome both personal and cultural inhibitions, right? I mean, it's one thing. It is one thing to say, because we talked about this before, right? We talked about this in the sense of, like, marrying your dead friend's husband, right? And, like, how that could, you know, so we talked about the dynamics of that. That's an issue already, right? So she has personal inhibitions against marrying Finwë because she would, you know, is it out of loyalty to her friend? Does she feel disloyal to her friend in marrying Finwë? Is it the relationship with her and Finwë weird if she's just like, hi, I'm a surrogate for, I'm like taking you over from my friend. Like, it's just, what is their relationship based on? It's just lots of potential for weirdness there, right? So there's that.
Yeah.
But then when we superimpose onto that the fact that it's deeply weird for an elf to remarry. In
yeah.
fact, it had been like, it's like forbidden for elves to remarry. Like, this is a
yeah.
this is an actual taboo among elves.
Right. Well, I think the focus for the weirdness is going to be a problem no matter what we do, because our audience is going to be looking at it as, well, this is weird. This is her best friend's husband, because we in our minds have this idea that that's not okay. Whereas I don't think that would have necessarily been an issue for the elves. It certainly wasn't an issue through most of history.
Right. Well, the biggest issue, though, yeah, exactly. A modern audience would be looking at, like, so the proposition, Finwë remarries and marries his wife's best friend. The modern audience is likely to have problem with the last bit, right?
Right.
Of that.
It's a values dissonance, essentially, exactly. Is the problem.
The elves are going to have a problem with the first half of the statement, right? Finwë remarries. That's that. Whereas, like, a widower remarrying is not weird, right? I mean, of course, like, often this leads to family issues, right? Kids are not always 100% supportive. So the idea of, like, Feanor being disgruntled and not liking his stepmom, this is this is familiar territory emotionally and culturally, right? That's fine. But it's unheard of, as Marie says. Like, there's something like an actual cultural taboo against remarriage. So, and at the end of the day, I think we've got to take that away. Because if it's a taboo, I mean, if it's an actual cultural taboo, there are very few excuses for breaking a taboo of that kind. Right? The only one that I know of that's admitted in modern storytelling is unconquerable passion, right? Unconquerable passion leads you to transgress taboos. And there's a long history of that, obviously. But if it's not unconquerable passion, then what? And I don't think we are going to be showing Indis and Finwë being like, I just can't resist. I am so madly and completely in love with you. I just, like, you know, cultural taboo be damned. Like, that's not going to be, that can't be their story.
Right.
It absolutely cannot be their story. And if not that, then what? We have made a calm and rational decision, and we have decided to eschew the cultural taboo because why? I owe it to Indis.
Reasons.
Because I still really want kids. I mean, there's no good reason for that.
That is the reason.
Yeah.
I think that is I don't know. I can't think of any other good reason for Finwë to do this other than the fact that he still wants other children.
Yeah. Mario, I agree. We don't want to have Indis already pregnant with Fingolfin when they get married.
Oh,
yeah,
dear.
We don't want to go there. Yeah. Ingwe with the shotgun. This is so totally what we want to avoid.
Well, one of the things that we did was try to set up her as a queen figure.
Right.
He's impressed by her. It's not just she's very beautiful, which yeah. obviously she is, but she impresses him. And he wants that as part of his in his family, essentially. Like, she adds something to when she comes to stay with him for a while, right? To kind of, you know, check in on everything. And she intervenes in situations, like, for example, there's a labor dispute with the Teleri because they're building Aqualande, and the Teleri keep putting things where they don't go, and it's driving the Noldoran craftsmen and foremen crazy, because they work very differently. The way that they think about things is very different. The Noldor have the plan, and they're following the plan, and the Teleri are just like, well, we can just put that there. Yeah, we'll just put that there. And that's completely makes sense to them. So there's this labor dispute that's going on, and Indis is able to bridge the gap between the two cultures.
Right, right. I mean, I like the idea of Indis being a good queen, as well as being, like, the personal connection with her being, you know, her being Muriel's friend, and the devotion that she feels to Finwë, which, like, she sort of got from her friend, right? That she's, you know, I like that. I think that all works really well. It's still not enough to break a taboo, a cultural taboo. Be like, but I really admire her as a person and a queen. Therefore, I'm going to break the cultural taboo. Like, it still doesn't work. So this is my suggestion. I think the only way to solve that problem is simply to make the cultural taboo post-date their remarriage. Their remarriage can be the reason for the taboo later on. People can be uneasy. Well, it's never happened before. So
yes.
People can be uneasy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
We can have several people kind of weirded out by it. Be like, remarriage, right? We're getting married to a second person.
Yeah.
That's weird. Yeah. But people are willing to be open-minded, and Indis and Finwë are keen. Feanor See, it's interesting because, of course, Feanor is the main person for the main spokesperson for the, like, I'm uncomfortable with this situation, but he is so obviously biasedly uncomfortable with the situation that, and but ironically, some of his presentiments turn out to be quite true, right?
Well, what we could do with this is, like, this has just never come up before. Nobody's ever tried to do this
right,
before.
Exactly.
And so
exactly.
So the elves do go to the Valar for a judgment on this, and the Valar say, okay, in this case, we're going to say it's okay because Muriel says she doesn't want to come out anyway. But in the future, you can't do this.
Well, I think, I don't even think it needs to be a law. I think that there can be uneasiness and uncertainty. Is this a good idea?
No. I'm saying that it starts out as just people are uncomfortable with it. But it should get up to the Valar because we do kind of need to address the whole Muriel choosing to remain in Mandos for eternity thing.
Yeah. And you know, Marie asks if they need the Valar's permission. The idea that there would be enough uncertainty about this that they might go to the Valar about it seems perfectly just. But anyway, what I'm saying is, though, as far as the cultural taboo is concerned, people are uncertain, people are uneasy, everybody decides to go along with it, and everybody kind of reconciles themselves to it except for Feanor. In retrospect, later on, after the fact, when the whole thing happens and we get the strife between, you know, Feanor and his half-brothers, and basically the elves are going to decide after this that, okay, you know what? On balance, having looked at what happened here, this was a bad idea. So we're not going to do this anymore. So if there is a cultural, an actual taboo against remarriage, it should come from this. It should be inspired by what happened here in retrospect. But we don't need to make, because again, I can't see it. I cannot possibly make sense of transgressing an active taboo under these circumstances.
Yeah.
Because again, this is only passion is the only one answer that we have as a culture to that question. Why do you break a major taboo like that? Unless, like, for gain, maybe, I suppose. Like, if the ends justify the means and you're trying to achieve something. But again, that's not relevant. So yeah, I just can't see it. I just can't see it happening.
Yeah.
But I can see, basically, the whole Finwë, Muriel, Indis, fall of the Noldor. Like, they remarried and, like, look at all the junk that happened after that. You know what, folks? Let's just not do this anymore. That kind of makes more sense that would happen organically. Basically, and I don't think we need. A couple of people were talking about the Valar and their relationship with this, and the Valar kind of making judgments. I don't think the Valar need to make a judgment about this. I don't think we need a proclamation about remarriage. They can just seek them, just go to them for advice. You know, somebody.
Yeah.
It doesn't even have to be Finwë. In fact, maybe it
could
be
it could be Ingwe going consulting
yes,
them
Ingwe
about
is,
it.
Of course,
yeah.
It would be Ingwe. Her dad,
yeah.
Right? Her dad,
yeah.
Who is the High King of the Vanyar and pretty tight with Manwë and Varda, goes to Manwë and Varda and is like, so have you heard the crazy thing my daughter wants to do? Like, what do you think?
Right.
Yeah, and
yeah.
Then and Mandos is there and he doesn't say much, and you know, it's
well, we do need to get that Muriel gives her blessing in a way.
Yeah.
Like, we need to give that. We need to give that information.
Yes.
Up.
Yes. Exactly. That Muriel has no intention of coming back, and it's because Ingwe's got to bring that up, right? I mean, Brian was pointing out, like Brian Yoder was saying, some people could even point out that his first wife is right there. Like, she's right over there, right? It's not even. She's not dead and gone, right? She's just.
She's not available.
She's unavailable, exactly. Right, but Marie, exactly, with the her pledge never to come back, and who's gonna report? It's got to come from Mandos, right?
Right.
It's got to come from Mandos. So we need a basically a conversation between Ingwe comes to consult Manwë and Varda, and Mandos is there, and so Mandos can say, no, she's never returning, and
she's taken up the service of Vyrae, or
yeah,
you know, something like
the
that.
Choices, the choices the choice is theirs. Like, you know, Mandos, of course, is going to tell him whether or not it's a good idea, but he is going to say that they're free to choose.
Because why would he?
Right, exactly. That's not his thing.
Okay, that's good. Is there anything? Because I mean, like, we have a couple of rapid fire weddings here. There's kind of no way around it because that's the timeline.
Exactly. Yeah. 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 A lot of time has to pass. I like the. I love the tag at the end. I just want to read the tag, actually. Matan's workshop. Nerdanel is carving a sculpture of a swan, which I love, while Feanor is working the forge. The camera focuses on Feanor's resolute face, reflecting the firelight of the forge. The shot fades into one of Feanor's face on a tapestry, also with firelight reflected on it. We see that Vyrae is looking at the tapestry, tears streaming down her face, show a glimpse of Muriel and Mandos as well. Yes, the juxtaposition with, and we've just had the swan dream from Olwey in the previous episode, right? Loving it. Okay, not the previous episode; it was the one before. But anyway,
yeah,
I love it. Love it.
I don't remember where this came from, but I'm pretty sure this was not our idea.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. Well, whoever's idea it was, it's awesome. I think this works really well. Again, I love Vyrae every time she comes in.
Somebody speak up and take ownership of this.
Yeah, I don't know. It's a good idea, but I love the juxtaposition there. I love the fact that like his relationship with Nerdanel itself is kind of made to look a little questionable. Like, is this a bad idea? Like, is this a? It's not a bad idea, of course, right? But it's gonna be. It was my idea, Marie. No way, really.
I think it was.
Okay. Well, cool. See, that's the great thing about being so forgetful is that you come at ideas. Like, it's, you know, you can be objective in assessing.
This is such a great idea. I wish I had thought of this.
It is. Yeah. That's wonderful. So great. I would have wished that I'd thought of it even if I hadn't. So cool. Yeah. So that's awesome. So anyway, I like it. I like the kind of the uncertainty about Nerdanel, because Nerdanel is going to look like not exactly a rebound, but she's somebody that he flees to. Because he wants no part of Indus, right? And so that could look like a bad idea. Like, we know Indus is really good, and so now he's like running around with this girl, and how's that going to work out? And we get this ominous foreshadowing. But of course, it turns out she's great, right?
Well, it's interesting. We talked about this during the session. How it's funny because the idea of Indus, of Finwë marrying again. Isn't going to seem weird at all to a modern audience, but that's the thing that the elves are really weirded out by. The fact that Feanor and Nerdanel get married very young, they have kind of this whirlwind romance. To the elves, that makes perfect sense, but to a modern audience, people are going to be like, they're a little young to be making life decisions.
Right. I know, they're only like a couple hundred years old at this point.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, I can't rush into things. Yep, no, I like that. I think that all works really well. Let's talk about episode. Let's at least begin talking about episode 8. I think we can do a bunch of episode 8. I will relinquish my ambitions to get to episode 9.
Episode 8, I think, was one of the first episodes where there started to be some friction.
Okay.
So basically, you guys had asked us to. The problem we had. Was that you guys had asked us to not have elves at the trial, which is doable. That's fine. And yet, if we do that, the elves are not introduced to the main conflict of the episode until like halfway through.
Right.
Which dramatically and cinematically doesn't work. So. What we wound up doing was to shift the protagonist of the episode from being one of the elves to being Melkor.
Uh-huh.
So I'm very curious how you guys felt about that.
I liked it, generally, okay. I think. I didn't have a problem with it. Having the action kind of center on Melkor all the way through, I think worked well. I like that choice in general. there are two main things. Okay, three main topics that I would want to talk about this episode. One is Melkor's actions at the trial. The second is Tolkas afterwards. And the third is the frame juxtaposition with Gollum. I loved the Tolkas' detective thing. That was freaking hilarious.
Yes.
That was absolutely great. And I loved the way that it makes him look, I mean, he's well-intentioned, but not that bright. And the way that it wrong-foots the people who are opposed to releasing him, right? It was cool. I liked it. One really important point, though, is the trial.
Yeah.
He shouldn't try to excuse himself.
Yeah. Okay.
He shouldn't try to excuse himself. He should be looking not for excuse, but he should be asking for forgiveness. I think his whole angle at the trial is, I was wrong. I see the error of my ways. I repent and I am sorry and I ask for your forgiveness.
Yes.
The response of Manwë and Nienna to that appeal, is clear. If he's trying to excuse himself, if he's like, well, there were extenuating, I know I probably should have, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And I regret that now, but it was, you know, a little bit out of my control. I mean, if he's making excuses, then he's not repentant, right? He needs to embrace what he did or appear to embrace what he did. He needs to appear to repent. And that's why, because that's when it comes down to, you wanted a conversation between Olmo and Nienna at, you know, near the end of the episode. And Nienna, like, basically what that has to come down, like, if he asks for, I mean, if he professes repentance and asks for forgiveness, like, it doesn't matter. Like, we might think it's a mistake to forgive him, but forgiving him is the right thing to do. He's asked for forgiveness. We should give it to him. That doesn't mean we have to trust him, but you know, completely. But we can't deny him forgiveness.
Agreed.
However, if we're talking about excuses, you can not believe his excuses. You
know? Right.
That puts the whole thing on a totally different footing. So he just needs to be completely, completely repentant. Right. Completely.
Yes.
I think, Maria, I think he has to start there. I really do. I mean, if he does even the least bit of excusing, right? Because I mean it's a major distinction. The excusing and forgiving are two fundamentally different things, and there's no overlap between the two of them. If you excuse someone for something, you say it's not your fault. If you forgive someone for something, you say it is your fault. But I'm not going to hold you. I'm not going to continue, you know, being angry at you for that. I'm going to release my anger and my right of vengeance against what you did. It's a problem. I mean, I was just having this conversation with one of my children, actually. You know, like when I was urging him to forgive someone, and he said very naturally, "But what he did was wrong, and that's not okay." And I was like, yes, that's why you have to forgive him, not excuse him, right? It's not to say what you did was okay. It's not to say I think it's fine or I don't blame you. You do blame them. That's why you have to forgive them. So, again, this is where I think it is. I mean, it has to be kind of one or the other, excusing or forgiving. If he's going to argue extenuating circumstances, then basically what he's saying is I'm not fully culpable. And the Valar are not going to agree that he's not culpable. Like, that's a losing case with the Valar. And if the Valar did accept that case, they would be stupid. But if that's not his case, if he fully accepts guilt and says, I repent and I've changed and I've seen the errors of my ways and I promise I will work with you in the future, that's, you know... Then you can have the people who say, I don't believe him and I think he's faking. And you have others who say, I believe him. And you can have others who say, maybe he's faking, maybe he's not. But it's important that we give him the benefit of the doubt.
Right. The case of trying to make excuses would have been made when they first took him. That I can see.
Yes, yes.
I think the thought here was to kind of give the trial a little bit more a little bit more movement. Mm-hmm. But I agree that any time that he makes this an excuse, it makes it more difficult for him to convince us that he's repentant.
Yes, yes.
Because we're not only trying to convince the Valar here, we're trying to convince us that he is genuinely repentant.
Well, exactly. And because those two things, again, in both directions, right? If you're on the part of the person who has been wronged, right? Excusing and forgiving are two fundamentally different things. On the part of the person who is done the wrong, right? If they are asking to be excused or asking to be forgiven, those two are diametrically different things. Like, they just, you can't do both. If you're asking to be excused, then you're saying, I'm not responsible. So you can't both repent and ask for forgiveness and also attempt to excuse yourself. So therefore, yes, it's not, it wouldn't really be possible for the Valar with any kind of wisdom or justice to hear both of those things. I repent, but it wasn't really my fault. Anybody who says that is not really repenting, right? They've not really accepted what they did wrong. So he can't do that. And remember, it's not a trial. It's a parole hearing, right? It's not a trial. So we don't have to have... I would actually be fine with making the trial scene quite short. It could indeed be little more than them asking him, you know, like, his perspective and him making a speech wherein he, you know, says that he did wrong and that he repents. And it can be super moving and he can be super convincing. I think that's, well, Brian Federini says they just had an earthquake in the middle of that. Brian, do you think it was a sign? Earthquake probably means I'm right, right? I assume that's what that means. Wow, I hope everything's okay over there, Brian.
Almost certainly, that's what it means.
Yeah,
it's, I figure. Definitely not coincidence.
I figure, yeah, that's. But
it could also show that the Valar are displeased with Melkor's defense.
Right. Exactly. But see, Marie, I don't think he has to. Like, Marie is asking the question about, like, is he admitting wrongdoing for everything? Like, is Melkor going to cop to the destruction of the lamps and everything? I don't even think we have to go there. I don't think we have to itemize it. You know, he's been found guilty of the charges. That's why he was in prison, right? Like, and his trials already happened. His parole is not about the facts of his case. His parole is about his attitude, and his attitude can be general, not specific. He doesn't have to. He doesn't have to talk about. They don't have to review the particular things. Exactly.
And while I know that there had been reticence to show interior scenes of Mandos, uh-huh. I felt that showing him locked in Mandos and kind of like showing that he's been there for a while,
right,
goes a long way to selling this idea that, you know, that he may be repentant.
Sure.
That his repentance may be genuine.
Yeah. Having this, this kind of this would be a really difficult piece of acting by our person whose name I forget, who is
Michael Fassbender. Michael, I'm confident he can do it.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
That he would have to, because basically, like, the as he is, you know, there in solitary confinement in Mandos, he would have to look in such a way that could either be like, I am stewing in prison, but also like, I am thinking over my deeds and
introspective.
He has to be introspective in a way which can be ambivalent in that
yes.
way.
Because it's not like they're watching him on CCTV or something.
Oh, right, exactly. And Brian Yoder asks, are we getting an old, frazzy-haired, long-bearded, unkempt prison jumpsuit Melkor? No, not exactly. I mean, in fact, I think we should show very little of his conditions, right? I mean, like...
I agree.
Maybe just kind of him in the darkness, essentially.
We had thought of a dark version of the arming room in The Matrix. Where, like, there's no apparent walls.
Right. Yes. Yes. In fact, it could be reminiscent of him in The Void.
Yes.
Back in season one. Yeah.
Yep.
Which is, of course, a really interesting parallel to make, right? Because when he was in The Void, I mean, he went into The Void on purpose, right? It was part of his ambition going into The Void.
Yeah. And this way, there's no corner for him to be doing push-ups in.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, he doesn't need a pull-up bar or anything. And he will have gotten no tattoos.
Yes.
The other thing I really liked conceptually, I love how, so this in the frame of this episode is where you were doing the Arwen and leaves Lorien and goes to the Woodman and they hear about some dark creature that has crept out and is stealing babies. I really like that. I mean, that's a really kind of ominous parallel. I mean, I felt like it was, the parallels were a little bit underdeveloped.
Trying to figure out where that was.
She's still, it's not until the next episode, right, that she actually does the healing thing, or does that happen here?
Honestly, I'm really lost on where we are with the frame at this point, but that makes sense both ways.
Yes, I think it was. Yes, it was, because the frame of episode 9 is the Mirror of Galadriel frame, which it's just as well that we didn't get to that, because I have a whole heck of a lot to say about the Mirror of Galadriel, and that will be a good opening for next time. That's what I can take the first half of the episode semi-irrelevantly rambling on about next session, so that'll be good. The juxtaposition is nicely ominous, right? I mean, as I was saying before, we're not actually trying to deceive the viewers. The viewers know about Morgoth. What I want is something that will enable them to suspend disbelief about him. I want his story to be plausible all the time, such that maybe the seeds of doubt are sown, right? I don't want people to be like, wow, I'm totally convinced. He's awesome now from episode 8 onwards. What I want is for them to believe that he's, you know, for them to be on Olmo's side, basically, you know, almost like their hero and speak like, you know, the one whom who is speaking aloud the audience's own reservations about the choice to let Melkor go. And yet their expectation that his villainy is going to be revealed is going to be continually postponed and continually postponed. And I want to make sure, again, my only goal is to make sure that his actions are, it is plausible that both the Valar and the Noldor can react to him in the ways that they do, because that's what matters. I'm not trying to conserve Melkor in the minds of our audience. I'm not trying to resuscitate him in their opinion. What I am trying to do is preserve their opinion of the Noldor and the Valar. And not to be, because I mean, we've all been there, right? We've all been there on TV shows where we're like, how could you be so stupid? Like, why are you doing that? It's obvious he's a villain, right? We don't want people shouting that at their screens for the whole second half of season 2. We want them to be, they can be frustrated. They can be like, it's so insidiously awful, like what he's doing. And I can see how, you know, these other Elf and Valar characters whom I like and respect are being deceived. But it needs to work. It needs to be plausible. It needs to be able to hold. Again, the point is not to try to hoodwink our viewers, because they've seen in season 1 enough to be able to know that to be able to be on Olmo's side, and Olmo is voicing that overtly, right? So we have that point of contact with him. I just don't want him to be I don't want him to become a cheesy villain, and I don't want that, because again, remember thinking back to where I started with my long digression about Sauron, he's not had his destruction of the lamps moment yet. Right, it's going to be the destruction of the trees. So basically, Morgoth himself, Melkor himself, is theoretically redeemable still. I mean, it's possible. He could do it. He could repent. After the destruction of the trees and the burning of his hand, I don't think he can anymore. And that's a Tolkienian thing, like that there does come a point where, like, you've passed the point of no repentance. That's what happens to Gollum on the stairs of Cirith Ungol. I would argue that's what happens to Sauron in Numenor. That's what happens to Morgoth at the destruction of the lamps. That's what happened to the Balrogs at the Balrogs at the destruction of the lamps. Morgoth at the death of the trees. It is a very real possibility. It is possible he could repent. Yeah.
Right.
And I do like the ending of the probation at the end.
Mm-hmm.
How, you know, the idea of him sort of like doing something to really earn their trust sufficiently so that they see like he really is working for the good of the people. One thing,
right.
The one thing I would say, the things you guys have him do, like the public works that he's kind of doing, are kind of blue collar, right?
Well, that was actually a deliberate decision, being that so he's got this bracelet on, right? And it's the same link of the chain that he used to lock down Eomwe, way back in season one.
Right.
And so basically what it does is it restricts, he doesn't have access to his elemental power. So like any time that he approaches Aule with, well, I want to do this. And Aule's like, well, you have to do that with your own two hands. So good luck with that. it's, we're deliberately making him actually work for this.
Okay. Okay.
So again, what,
so
you know,
the very
when,
humility of those actions is a good sign, basically.
Right.
The fact that he's willing to undertake humble public works projects for the benefit of the people,
right,
is,
he's not supervising. He's actually doing this with his own two hands.
Right. And of course, it's only been exactly one season ago. Well, okay, a couple episodes more than one season ago, that we had him in charge of the construction of the lamps, right?
Right.
So doing public works projects is a thing for him, and of course a thing which had a history. Like, that was the big warning sign, right?
And
it was his pride, right? It was his arrogance and his desire to be, and his friction with Aule. Remember, I mean that
right.
That was all there. So,
and he also didn't physically do anything to build
right.
the lamps. That's another thing.
Exactly.
He didn't have a personal hand in their building. He
was the foreman.
Right. He was trying to run the show. Yeah. So there's that. We had a terror of a time trying to find things for him to do that would be helpful. That would also fit in with the Tulkas as detective thing, because we had to give him the project a dangerous element that he had to acquire from Aule so that Feanor could be present with it when Tulkas asks Aule about this, so that Feanor can say, well, that's dumb, you shouldn't have given that because it's super dangerous because of this, and then Tulkas goes and smashes it. So it had to be something that was smashable and had a dangerous element that he would get from Aule. So that was very, very difficult.
Yeah.
We only within the past week, I think, were able to find things that worked. So,
yeah, it's tricky. I do acknowledge that that's tricky, and I do kind of like, especially with the parallel to the lamps. I think that works really well to sort of, you know, it would work really well as a kind of test case to see how much he's really changed.
Right.
So,
and having Tulkas break it is just that's fantastic. I think
it is. I like it. All right, the Tulkas smashing and the incompetence of Tulkas as investigator. I really did kind of love that. Yeah, Maria, I hear what you're saying. Maria says she's not sure how she feels about creating engineering projects in Valinor for Melkor to do. That was my thought too, but it does make sense. I mean, I see how it holds together,
mm-hmm.
And especially,
and there's not really a way around it either.
Well, especially if we can do the, if we can be clearly evoking and, you know, making a sort of parallel and anti-parallel with the construction of the lamps in the middle of the last season, I think that that could work really well.
Yes.
So, okay. All right. Good. Good. Yeah. So I was fine with all that. Going back to the Gollum thing, though. Of course, this gives a pretty clear. I mean, the parallel is a little bit lovely, right? Something dark and evil has crept out of a hole somewhere and is now inflicting suffering upon the community at the same time that Melkor is being released on probation, right? I mean, yeah. That parallel is a little hard to miss, right? Mm. It kind of works since it works against, I mean, it works in an interesting way since it works against everything that's going on in the episode itself, in a sense. Maybe it even gives a, maybe you could even use it to build the suspense about the, it creates a false parallel, essentially. Like maybe we have Arwen, we parallel Arwen as detective with Tulkas as detective, right? You know, she's trying to figure out what is the evil thing that is, you know, what is causing the suffering of the people as Tulkas is coming. And so it looks like, the fact that she discovers that it's the, that it's, you know, this Gollum creature, at the same time that Tulkas discovers what he believes to be Melkor's insidious plot, creates an interesting moment of like disappointment, right?
That... If there was more time in the frame, you could do almost like a witch hunt.
Yes, yes.
Which would kind of, that parallel would be a lot better, but
right. That's, of course, the big problem with this frame episode is that it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah.
At the end of it. Well, or at least there's no resolution to it because, obviously, we can't have Arwen catch Gollum. Gollum has to be gone by the time she gets there.
Yeah.
And she's not going to go hunting him across all the lands. You know, that's her future boyfriend's future job. So we need... not to go, but so basically she's going to come back and she's going to focus on helping the woodsmen to heal, you know, and sort of helping them in their need, in their suffering, but she can't. So if we get her too much looking into like the truth of the dark shadow that has been creeping into their homes, we're not going to have any resolution to that story.
Could they be suspicious of her? Would that help?
Yes.
Strengthen the parallel?
They would, wouldn't they?
Yeah. I mean, think about the way that Éomer talks about Galadriel. Yeah, exactly. And if she's able to find a way to win them over.
Yeah, she's a sorceress.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, no, you're right. It makes perfect sense that that would be their reaction. Especially people who have been suffering a mysterious, you know, a set right. of mysterious hardships. I mean, that is the kind of occasion on which people often will kind of look around for a witch anyway, and then here one shows up, right?
Yeah. It would have to be done very quickly and very tightly and very efficiently.
Yeah, because we have essentially Arwen on trial.
Right. We don't have time for like a lengthy thing with that. But if she shows up to help them and nobody wants to talk with her. People start accusing her, and she and when we come back, she's able to find one person who's willing to let her help their injured child, and
yes,
you know, yes. like that kind of thing. It actually makes me think of you remember Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, where Little John's wife is in childbirth, and Hazim, Morgan Freeman's character,
right.
I presume does a cesarean,
right,
or something like that on her, when it looks like Friar Tuck can't do anything for her.
Right,
it's
right.
kind of that.
Yeah,
in a way.
I mean, it could work. I mean, I'm thinking what I can't help but do with these frame things, and it's one of the things that I love about the frame is the ability the way that it enables us to kind of make these parallels and really kind of emphasize and echo the story in other ways. It kind of gives
right.
a an additional dimension to the themes that we're discussing during the episode. And what this would be, so if you basically think about the sort of the big picture outline of the frame incident here, creature emerges from the shadow and enters the society, and not only brings about immediate suffering to the people in the society, but also foments discord between two groups of people who should be trusting each other and getting along, right?
Right.
As an outline, that works well, right? As a kind of foreshadowing of what Melkor's emergence is going to do, and the discord that he is going to bring. In the frame, we show it being healed, the breach, right?
Yes.
So it shouldn't be about. So the emphasis should not be about Arwen trying to figure out what went wrong, because the creature's long gone. But what it could be about is about if the primary thrust is about trust or not trust. Do we trust or do we not trust this person? Because then their distrust of Arwen serves as a really interesting kind of foil for distrust of Melkor.
Right. Right. And again, when I approached this episode, I approached it with the idea of, I'm going to sell this. I'm going to find a way to sell this thing that I don't believe.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, I like that. I like that. So what if there was a child who was injured by Gollum, like the last child that he attacked, who escaped because like his parents came in and chased him off before he could kill or drag away the child, but he is still, the child is injured and may die, and so she heals the child and thereby wins the trust of the parents and the community. So the climax of the frame episode there is reconciliation between her and the elves or and the woodmen.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, that works. I like that.
Okay.
Good. Okay. Well, that's good. We got through episode 8. See, everyone was all worried, and we got through episode 8 after all.
Because that's as far as we were aiming in the first place.
Well, we were aiming for 9, but 8's good. 8's perfectly fine.
Oh, yeah. Before he can get them, you know?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I'm sure I will have beaten predictions. So great. Excellent. So we'll pick up at 9 next time. And since my digression at the beginning next time will be much more relevant and less long than my... Mm-hmm. But I'm really glad we did the Sauron talk. I feel much better about that. So anyway...
And next time we get to talk about hashtag make Fingolfin great again. It'll be awesome.
Exactly. Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. That'll be good. So we'll see if we can get all the way through 13 next time. That will be the highly ambitious goal of our next episode. We should be all right. Okay. Good. Excellent.
Based on past experience, I'm sure we can do it.
Oh yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, I think
confident.
And don't forget, nominations open for nomination voting. Open.
That's right.
There's going to be a bunch of people very excited.
Discussion board. It's there now. Click, open, survey, click, click, click for your votes.
Right.
I know Marie is super excited.
Yes, yes. And I do want to sort of reiterate, as we've said before, the outlines that we're discussing and that we're going to continue discussing next time, that we're going to complete discussing next time, mm-hmm. are available. Yes, they're on the forum.
Yes, I think that what we'd like to do is at some point have a separate forum thread that just has approved outlines. So outlines that you guys have greenlit, as you know, if somebody wants to play around with them, they can,
right?
Because they are fully approved and ready for actual scripting.
Right.
If somebody wanted to do that,
right? Right. Sure. Good. All right. Excellent. Well, we will see you. We look forward to next time talking about episodes 9 through 13. Thanks again, Nick, for joining us today and being the vocal representative of the script writing, the script outlining crew. I appreciate all that. And
thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks very much. So we will
will say thanks for listening and Godspeed.